This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
If you will follow my laws and commandments, etc., etc., then the following is going to happen. This is a wonderful place to look and see what it's all about. What's going to happen if we follow the rules and principles of the Torah? The Torah goes on. We'll have rain at the right time, and the land will be full of its produce, and the fruit will be given from the trees, etc., etc., etc. And you go read on and on, and it's all material reward, which is a bit strange for a religion that claims to be so spiritual. That the only reward the Torah can think up over here, where it talks, this is the one place in the Torah where the Torah comes to define what is the reward of doing it, what is the result of following the Torah, what can you expect out of it. And all we can find that we can expect out of it is a bit of wealth, military security, a rising population, that's it, that's about it, and peace. If one looks at each one of these rewards, whatever you want to call it, results of keeping the Torah separately, then it's correct, each one of them is a material reward. But the Maor B'Shemesh points out, and the Ramban says something very similar, that if you look at them together, and they're given together, unlike the Klolos, then it's something indicative of spiritual success. Because, says the Maor B'Shemesh, to look at the physical affluence, the material affluence, and see that as a reward, that's very nice, but it's material. To look at peace as a reward, that's also very nice, but it's material. But for there to be peace when there's affluence, that's not material. In a material society, when there's affluence, there's not peace. And when there's peace, there's not affluence. Says the Maor B'Shemesh, two poor people, they have peace. There's nothing to fight about, so they're peaceful. Neither poor man has got something that the other one's envious about. But in a society of affluent people, you don't have peace. To have peace and affluence together, to have interpersonal harmony, total harmony, this means that there's not a feeling of dissatisfaction or a feeling of jealousy or hatred, whatever, but there's total harmony. To have total harmony in a society that is also affluent, that's not physical and material, that's spiritual. That's an incredible statement of the Maor B'Shemesh. The Ramban goes further, and the Ramban says not only is it spiritual, he says it's miraculous. He says this is not something natural. It's natural that any one of these rewards could exist on its own, or a few of them together. But for all of them to exist, for all of the people, all of the time, that's miraculous. And if one looks at that statement of the Ramban's in specific relation to the statement of the Maor B'Shemesh, it makes a lot of sense too, that what the Torah is saying is that the achievement of spiritual harmony must not be at the expense of physical affluence. There's no chap to have a nice Jewish society where everybody learns and everybody gets on well with each other, and everybody's as poor as a doormat. That's not what the Torah's gearing towards. The Torah would like to see everybody wealthy. That's brocha. That's considered, there's no brocha in poverty. But that wealth has to be achieved, not at the cost of spiritual dignity and spiritual stature. And if it can be achieved together with the spiritual stature to the point where you have peace and affluence together, then you have stature, then you have real spiritual stature. And this raises a problem. Because one can conclude, let's just understand that a little bit better. The reason that you can't normally or naturally have peace together with affluence is because wealth is finite. There's only a certain amount of wealth in the world. If you multiply the gross national product of all the countries of the world by the number of countries in the world, you've got the total wealth of the world. There is no more than that. That's what it is. And each person wants a share in that wealth. And the bigger my share, the smaller your share. If there's a finite amount of wealth, then anybody who's got more than me has taken it from me in a sense. And hence the rise of socialism and this whole business where an individual without looks at the guy with and feels he's being done out of something. And in a sense he's right, because the moment a sense passes from you to me, it's really at someone's expense. It's coming to me at your expense. And in such an environment, shalom can't exist. In such an environment, peace can't exist, because peace is only when you don't feel threatened. He says only when you don't feel that that guy's got something that you should have, or that you've got to keep what you've got and not let him get anything of what you've got. The only time you can have peace and security is when you don't feel threatened. To be affluent and not threatened means that your affluence is not material. I've always said materialism does not mean having money. You can be a spiritual person who's a millionaire, and you can be a materialist who's a doormat, a church mouse. You can't measure the degree of materialism of a person in terms of how much money he has. That's totally irrelevant. It's a question of his whole relationship to his material belongings. Even if his material belongings exist and have nothing more but his shoes and his suit of clothes, and he has nothing else, he might be a materialist. You might have a man with 10 Rolls Royces, and he's not a materialist. The man who's the materialist is the man who sees his wealth as something finite, and therefore has to feel insecure and resentful about anybody who threatens him on the level of wealth. The spiritual man is a man who feels secure. That his wealth is something which is given to him to fulfill his purpose in this world. He needs so much, and somebody else needs more, somebody else needs less. It makes no difference to him. All he wants to know is that this is enabling him to do what he has to do in the world, and he gets on with it and does it. And he sees his wealth as something coming not from other people, and not from the gross national product of the countries, of the country in which he's living, but he sees it as brocha, and this is the essence of what brocha is. Brocha is something which the Ribbono Shel Olam brings to you in overflow. It's not that he's scraping it out of the barrel and dishing it up to you. In brocha is the concept of there's so much that you can have, as much as you want, take it, enjoy it. That's what brocha is. The man who's able to view his wealth as brocha and see it as something which is coming from God, not at your expense and your expense, but the Ribbono Shel Olam has given it to me. It's nothing to do with anybody else. That's a man who can relate to his wealth on a spiritual basis and can use his wealth, in fact, to build his stature rather than to lower his stature. But the man who sees his wealth as the result of his own efforts entirely, he's basically taken it from somebody else and is insecure about it. So it comes out that where there's peace, or where there's not peace, let's put it that way, there's not spirituality. That's for sure. No matter how long the beard is, if there's not peace, there's not spirituality. And one then understands the Ramban statement that this is a miracle. Because in terms of economics, it's not like that. The concept of brocha is not a concept they teach you in economics at university. Because it's against the natural cycle of economics. The natural cycle of economics is that there's only so much wealth, and people have to produce more to earn more. That's the only way you're going to get it, get more. The concept of brocha, that wealth can actually be bestowed upon a nation or an individual by the Ribbono Shel Olam directly, by him simply reprogramming the economic cycle. It's a very simple thing. But that concept, the element of godliness, of spirituality in economics, is not discussed in university. That's why one has to go to yeshiva before you go to university. The fact that it's miraculous to have peace together with economic affluence is one thing that we understand. But there's a more severe problem. And that is that it now seems that it is possible to have disharmony, conflict, within Torah. Because if the Torah becomes quantitative, then there can't be peace either. As long as I feel that my progress in Torah is a quantitative thing, and that competition is measured quantitatively, then I resent anybody who deprives me of anything, or who has more than I have. I once gave a shiur a long time ago, which was basically a shiur that I heard from our Rosh Hashiva in Mir, you might remember, where we talked about how do you know whether your approach is right or not, and how do you know whether you're following the right approach within Yiddishkeit. And we came out that one of the essential elements was shalom. There must be peace both internal, you must feel at ease and at peace with other people, and there must be a physical lack of conflict between you and other people in order for your principle, for your theory to be right. If there's not shalom, if there's conflict among people, then your approach in Torah is not correct. But it's the same as it's necessary in economics to elevate oneself from the finite to the infinite, so it is necessary in Torah to make sure that one elevates oneself out of the finite into the infinite. Make sure that one ceases to see things merely as an accumulation of facts or an accumulation of data, and to feel one's whole progress only in the sense of that accumulation. How does one do it? And this is the problem, because the building up of this kind of stature is really in order to do that, one needs to cross the bridge from technical expertise into spiritual perception and into spiritual understanding, coming back to what we discussed last week. And the question is now, where do you get the spiritual understanding from in Torah? You can learn and learn and learn, and we've often remarked that learning seems no guarantee to refinement, because there are many people who have learned an awful lot and they're still a bunch of nobodies. But there seems to be a necessity to find the right way to learn, and if you're learning the wrong way, it's not helping you at all. And one can learn, and that's no guarantee to anything. Where does one ensure, or how does one ensure, that in one's learning one's getting the essence of it, that in one's learning one's not only accumulating the data and the facts which one needs, but at the same time one's getting the neshama, one's getting the soul of it all, one's elevating the thing from something technical into something spiritual. And we raised the question last week, in fact, and I pointed out that that spiritual side of Torah can't be written down. You'll remember the Gemara in Sanhedrin, where the Gemara discussed why you can't start a court case on Friday and finish it on Sunday. The Gemara says because the judges won't remember the facts of the case. The Gemara says, but their secretary is there that write down every word of the case so they can reread the case after Shabbat. And the Gemara concludes that you can only write down the words, but you can't write down the heart. And a case has to be judged not only on the basis of the technical data and fact, but the case has to be judged on the feeling, on the soul of the whole case as felt by the judges at the time of the pleadings. And that's something that can't be reconstructed after there's been a break in the case, and so the case has to be consistent and can't be interrupted by Shabbat. And I mentioned here that there seems to be an element in the judging which cannot possibly be written down, because if it could be written down, the secretaries would write it down. So there's an element which cannot be written down. Not only can it not be written down, but it's the most important element. Without that, you can't pass it. Without that, you can't make a legal decision. It's more important, in a sense, than the technical facts that have been claimed by the two parties to the argument. In that case, we asked last week, how do you get it? If you can't write that down, then you obviously can't define it. We discussed it in terms of the right and the left hand side of the brain. And if you can't define it, how can you teach it? And if you can't teach it, how do you learn it? You have a problem. You have to teach the technicalities of Torah is easy. But to teach the essence of Torah, which cannot be written, which means you won't find it in any book, that's the first you saw it from that Gemara in Sanhedrin, that Lamed Hay, you can conclude that the heart of Torah you won't find in any book anywhere. It cannot be written. And if you think you found it in a book, you know that you haven't. You know that you've misunderstood. It's impossible to be written. And it's not only possible to be written, it's impossible to be told. So if you think that you've heard it somewhere, you also know you're listening to the wrong thing. So where do you pick it up? Where do you find it? And I brought to you the Yerushalmi, where Rebbe said that all his Torah came from seeing the back of the neck of Rabbi Meir, and where Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish said all their Torah came from seeing a hand movement out of the sleeve of Rebbe. And we discussed there that the concept that has to be learnt is one not only of the technique, but of the artistry of Torah. And the artistry of Torah cannot be written, the artistry of Torah cannot be defined, and the artistry of Torah cannot be talked about. It can only be done. That's all. And the only place or only way you'll find it is by seeing it being done. You can't describe to somebody who's never heard music, you can't write what it is. And you can't describe to somebody who's never seen color what it is. And you can't describe to somebody who's never seen ballet what it is. You have to see it and experience it before you have any idea of what it is. That's what art is all about. Art is not something which can be technically or technologically defined. And I want to take that concept further to understand how one does it lemaisa. There's a problem. This goes back to Robert, you asked me something 18 months ago. Something I'm going to answer now. In the relationship between a Rav and a Talmud, you have a problem. Firstly, because it's a unique relationship, and a relationship which is foreign, in a sense, to society altogether. On a Sabbath and a family. Strictly speaking, therefore, and it now makes a lot of Gemaras begin to make sense, the only way for the Talmud to break this deadlock of needing to know the Rav intimately, and yet the Rav obviously wanting to be left alone, is to become a plumber. Okay, now that sounds strange, but a lot of things start falling into place. There's a Gemara in Ksubis, which we'll come to in a few weeks on Daf Yud Zayin. A few months. Where the Gemara says, Tanu Rabbonon, we learnt in a Braisa, Mevatlin Talmud Torah Lohetzayas Ameis Chachman, in Torah, which is the most important of all the mitzvahs, in order to bury a dead person, or to entertain a caliph, a bride. Asked Tosfos from a Gemara from Mishnah in Derech Eretz, Amar Rabbi Akiva, where Rabbi Akiva says, Tchilat Tashmisha Lifnei Chachomim, at the beginning, in an early stage of my apprenticeship with the Chachomim, Pam Achat Hayiti Mahalech Baderech, once I was walking along the road, Umatzati Meit Mitzvah, and I found a Meit Mitzvah. Meit Mitzvah is not just a dead body, but a dead body who has nobody to attend to him, and therefore the first person who finds him has to attend to him. But it's palpable, Dalit Milin, and I took care of him for about 5 kilometers. In other words, I carried him 5 kilometers to the cemetery and I buried him. Actually, I waited the Vesak Forest until I brought him to the cemetery with Kavati and I buried him. With the Shabbati, when I got to the base of Medrash, and obviously the Rebbe wanted to know why I was late, but he stated the Vora, Lifne Rabbi Elezer, Rabbi Yeshua, and I told Rabbi Elezer and Rabbi Yeshua what had happened and what I had done. Amruli, they said to me, Al kol psia upsia ki ilu shafachta dam naki. You must not, don't come here bragging about the wonderful mitzvah you did. It's as if you for every step you took, it's as if you murdered an innocent person. Chachamim don't use language lightly. It's carefully measured. We're talking about a Rabbi Akiva. Every moment of his time could have influenced who knows how many people. If he would have been a little bit greater than he really was, and left us than he turned out to be, and left us a still greater heritage than he did, who knows? A Hitler might never have come to be. Could have affected the whole of humanity at this stage. Not only was Yiddishkeit at its very formative years, but all religions were. Christianity hadn't really taken off. It might never have taken off had Rabbi Akiva been greater. One never knows the effect of greatness. And a person who is potentially great doesn't have the right to waste 1 minute in not becoming great. So to be able to bring about his full potential and influence the world in whatever great way he can. But oxytosis, that's all very well, but there's a braisa against it. The braisa says you are permitted. That's mitzvah, you're allowed to waste time. This is the one mitzvah for which you're allowed to stop learning no matter how great you are, and you're allowed to go and bury the person. Rabbi Yehuda from Kurvil answered, yes, you're right. Stop learning. If you're learning Gemara, you have to entertain a bride, or you have to go and bury somebody who needs care, no question you stop learning. But Shimush Tamidei Chachomim, if you're busy serving a Talmid Chochem, that you don't stop for. You're busy serving her or fixing his plumbing, or putting on his jacket, that even for a Beit Mitzvah you don't stop. The Godel Shimusha Yotem Minimuda, because we have a principle in Gemara Brochus that Shimush Tamidei Chachomim is more important than learning Torah. I've never understood that. How can it be more important than learning Torah? What can you know? The fact is, you've got to learn. But you remember last week and on previous weeks I brought you another Gemara too that says a person can be a Lamdan, he can be a Talmid Chochem who's learnt and knows the whole of Shas from beginning to end, Vadol Shimesh Talmidei Chachomim, and he didn't have the opportunity of serving a Talmid Chochem, he's an Amar Oretz. And there's a Shaila whether you can join him to the benching if there are two people and him at the table. That means there's a guy who can learn a little bit and he's been Meshamesh a Talmid Chochem, he's worked for the Talmid Chochem, another guy the same, and there's another guy, a long black coat and a beard, is a Rosh Yeshiva with thousands of Talmidim, but he's never worked for a Talmid Chochem. You've got to come to the benching, start to shayla whether you can join him in to make him a Zuman. Because Al Pi Halacha, it's possible that he's an Am Haaretz, but he's not a person of the stature that is required to make up a Zuman. And we pass up there at the moment, it's not when one gets into it, but it's a shayla. This is something we like to forget about, you see, because we like to technicalize everything. And it makes us very uncomfortable to think there's something you can't learn in the book. That there's something you can't do yourself that you need someone else for. And it can't be prepared for you, and it can't be given to you in a Reader's Digest form, and it can't be vacuum packed for you. It's something you've got to find and discover yourself. There's no shortcut, there's no other way that it can be done, and you need someone else for it. But I want to discuss why the Shimush is so essential. Another Gemara in Kesubis, on the Tzadivav Amudal. Om Rabbi Yochanan, says Rabbi Yochanan, Kol hamonea talmidei b'lashamsho, if a man stops a talmid from assisting him in terms of shimush, ki'ilu monea mimeno chesed, it's as if the rov had an opportunity to do a chesed, to do a kindness, and he didn't do it. So don't look upon it in the sense that this is a Gemara addressing itself to the rov. Don't look it upon it to yourself in the sense that he's doing you a favor and you must accept the favor for him, whatever it is. He's not doing you a favor at all. You're doing him a favor. And if you don't allow him to assist you, you're doing him out of a chesed from you. We'll discuss that in a moment. Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak says, Af Perek Mimendo Yiras Shemayim. He's denying him the opportunity to develop Yiras Shemayim, to develop awareness of the Ribbono Shel Olam. This is also a very severe Gemara. And there's a most incredible Maharal on this Gemara, where the Maharal says exactly this problem of the strange, tense situation in which a relationship between a Rav and a Talmud finds itself. On the one hand, incredible intimacy. On the other hand, distance. Remember, we discussed a couple of weeks ago, and I don't remember how we came onto it exactly, this problem of, we sort of concluded that it's for the leader to go out of his way to be a people's man, and for the people to stop it if they want a leader in future times. Here we've got a slightly different concept that the Maharal introduces based on this Gemara. He says, number one, on the first one, why is it a chesed of the Rov to allow the Talmud to be mishamish, to allow the Talmud to do something? And it goes against the grain of the Rov, obviously, because the guy has developed his own independence and doesn't like to be helped. Yet the Gemara says, you've got it, whether you like it or not, you've got it, it's only fair. Why is it only fair, and why is it considered a chesed on the part of the Rov to the Talmud? Says the Maharal, that's the only way the Talmud can develop intimacy with the Rov. Every other aspect of the relationship has to be distance. In the sense, after all, it's the Rov giving and the Talmud taking. There's a certain question of Kovod HaTorah, of Yiro, etc., etc., etc. There's no other area where the two can interact on an intimate basis. It's not a social relationship, it's not a family relationship. So what relationship is it? Teacher-student, that's a relationship of distance. How are you going to turn a relationship of teacher-student into a relationship of intimacy? Says the Maharal, you've got to reverse it. It's always the teacher giving to the student. The only way you can do it is the student has to give to the teacher jolly well has to take it. Because that's the only way that they're interrelating in a new capacity and on a new level and with a new dimension. But, says the Maharal, at the same time, as essential as it is for a Talmud to develop a relationship of intimacy with a Rebbe, because there's no way that a Talmud can learn, we'll discuss it in a moment, can really learn if there isn't such a relationship, there's a problem. The moment he's developed a relationship of intimacy, he also can't learn. Why? You remember I've told you that the Yiro is badly translated as fear of God. I've always said it's not fear of God, it's sensitivity to God. But what is the connection? Why is it mistranslated, and why do we use the word Yiro? If I go and listen to a pianist playing the piano, on the understanding that I'm as good a pianist as him, I can forget it. There's no point in even going. What am I going to notice? I won't even be sensitive to the nuances of his own unique way of playing the piano. You know, I'll be listening to it very casually and without the necessary sensitivity. Sensitivity exists with awe. Only when there's awe and when there's the order which we discussed when we talked about Kohanim, is there an atmosphere conducive to sensitivity. You go in and there's a build-up and this wonderful pianist and I'm a nobody next to him and gotta hear how he plays this piece. Then you'll listen carefully and every little nuance you'll notice to see how this wonderful, in what way is this wonderful pianist different to you. But if you're going on the basis that you're equals, there's no way you're going to listen to anything at all. And I mentioned to you that the different societies achieve it in different ways, and the incredible assistance I found when we went to visit the Rebbe in New York, in the aura that they build up. Right? He doesn't do it, his henchmen do it. And they do it so incredibly effectively. And they could have got us in earlier, and even when we were there, they could have slipped us in, but they kept us waiting until 2 o'clock in the morning, and they build up, and they build up, and they build up, and it gets more and more. When you go in, you are so geared for every word he says, and you know that you're only going to be in there for a moment, and they warn you before you go in, so 1 minute, that's it, and then you're out, and so you're all keyed up, and you're sensitive to it. There is such an aura and such a build up that those 10 minutes, you achieve what you would achieve in a normal hour interview. Different people do it in different ways, but without that, if it was casual, you know, I used to phone up the Rebbe and said, when can I come and see you? And he said, I'm going to town, join me at the bus stop in an hour's time. You know, so you would spend an hour in the bus with him to town, you wouldn't have the intensity that you have in those 10 minutes. Same Rebbe, talking about the same things, what's the problem? You're not ready for the sensitivity, you're not geared up. This awe hasn't been built up, and this aura hasn't been built up. So you're going along with a buddy. So the two buddies will chat. But that's not a way you can learn. To learn in any field, you've got to be mevatel yourself. You've got to make yourself, for the purpose of that learning, insignificant in the life of the person who's teaching you. Otherwise, forget about learning. And says the Maharal, This is the incredible thing about Shemesh. It's an action which at the same time creates intimacy and simultaneously preserves the all. It's an intimate action, yet it doesn't interfere with the build-up of this special relationship that we're talking about. It's intimate because you're rubbing shoulders on the closest basis. And yet it's not as powerful. And so it doesn't disturb your possibility of listening carefully, of watching carefully. The plumber, when the plumber goes into the Chaim Brisker's house to fix the plumbing, he doesn't notice anything about the Chaim Brisker. If one of the times Talmidim would go in to fix the pipes, it would be an experience he never forgot. What's the difference? The Talmud is going in as Shemesh HaRav. He's going in as an opportunity to get a glimpse of the Rav. That's what he's going there for. The plumber is going there to fix the pipes. The plumber is interested in the pipes, and the Rav is just somebody who's got to pass on the way. The Talmud is going there to find out about the Rav, and the plumbing is the way he does it. It's a totally different thing, and it's a totally different relationship. That is the Maharal. Is the beauty of the Shemesh, and the essentialness of the Shemesh. There's no other way that an intimate relationship can be built up, yet retaining the atmosphere required for a dynamic learning process to occur. And this is something which exists on a number of different planes of stature. Rosh Hashiva and me used to point out a very interesting Gemara. Ben Azai said to somebody, Chaval al Ben Azai shelo shimesh et Rabbi Yishma. It's a terrible tragedy that I, Ben Azai, wasn't Mishamish Rabbi Yishmael. Says Rashi, who's the tragedy for? Hef said, Bechabolo hi ba'olam. It's a tragedy to the world. Ben Azai was greater than the world. But think how greater the world could have been if Ben Azai was still greater. Talmid Vatik Kamosi, somebody as experienced and as knowledgeable as me, I'm Ben Azai, Shelo Shimashti to Rabbi Yishmael, but I didn't have the opportunity of being Mishamesh Rabbi Yishmael, that's a terrible tragedy. I could have learned more from such an experience than anybody else. I am such a Talmid Chochem and I'm so advanced that had I had the opportunity to fix Rabbi Yishmael's plumbing, I would have seen things there that nobody else would have noticed. And the world has lost out because I didn't, and now Rabbi Yishmael is dead. But one has to have the perspective right. The same Rabbi Yish, the same Ben Azai, is the Ben Azai who says in Gemara Bechoros that except for Rabbi Akiva, he considers all the other Gedolim of his time to be like onion peels. Irrelevant, insignificant, you don't have to. They're not, Rabbi Akiva and him, he's second to Rabbi Akiva, and that's it. And these people didn't say that working out lightly, and it's not argued in the Gemara. It's accepted. So who's Rabbi Yishmael? An onion peel. And he's saying it's a tragedy for the world that I didn't have an opportunity to study Rabbi Yishmael. Because you see, Rabbi Yishmael couldn't teach Ben Azai anything in terms of learning. To teach Ben Azai the technicalities of learning, Ben Azai was better than Rabbi Yishmael. But Rabbi Yishmael was an artist. And you can watch a different pianist play the same symphony 50 times, 100 times, and you'll learn something from every single one of them. Because that is art. It's the uniqueness of his own way of doing it. And if you're in the business to become great, if you're in the business to learn and to develop oneself, says Ben Azai, how could I have been so foolish to allow an opportunity to study Rabbi Yishmael, not his words, not his writings, I know all that, but to see the artist at work. Had I seen the artist at work, the world would have been a better place, the world would have been a richer place, and now it's lost, there's nothing I can do about it. And this is what we mean when we talk about Talmud Torah altogether. Let me tell you, just to put it in perspective before that, don't look at this only in terms of you, the audience. You've got to understand that the more you learn and the more you keep, the more an outsider looks upon you as a rebbe, as somebody who is supposed to know something. It's pathetic that it's so. If it's tragic that it's so, that people look upon us as being somebody who's supposed to know what it's all about. But they do, whether you like it or not. And it doesn't help not wearing a yarmulke or telling everybody that you're... It doesn't help if you're learning, you're committed, you're involved in some way or another, you're supposed to know what it's all about. Which places a tremendous responsibility on the artistry. Because they are not people that want to come and hear you expound on Gemara. So they'll go to the kollel over there. But if they look at you as somebody who's involved, they'll watch little things. The way you speak, the way you dress, the way you walk, the way you relate to people. That's where they're going to look to try and see, what is this Torah business? Does it make any sense? Does it make a guy any better? And if that part isn't developed, not only is your learning meaningless, but it's thoroughly destructive. Then you're misrepresenting Torah. And you're putting yourself and Torah in a situation that you have no right to put yourself and Torah in. So it's vitally essential part of Torah which you can't learn out of the books. That has to be learned out of Shemesh. And one has to remember this Gemara with Ben Azai. And living in a place like Johannesburg, this is one of the problems of living in a place like Johannesburg, because there's not that much opportunity for it. But when the opportunity does come to see an artist at work, firstly, there are people, even in Johannesburg, that one can learn from an awful lot in terms of their artistry of living Torah. And one has to take the opportunity from time to time, dig up one of these people and do something with them. But just as important is, occasionally we're fortunate enough to have visits. You have an outstanding person who comes. Don't wait till he comes to ask you for money. It's too late. You've missed the opportunity already. When you hear that there's somebody in town like that, it's an opportunity. Study the artist at work, find him up, and ask what you can do for him. And find something you can do for him. Get rub shoulders with him a little bit. You drive him somewhere, you take him somewhere, you do something, whatever it is. It's an opportunity which one really has in Israel, in fact, because there they're busy with the Talmidim and all that, and very few Talmidim are able to establish such a relationship. But when they come out over here, they're open ground. Anybody can have a go. And what can be learned and what can be seen about Torah, really Torah, is the kind of stuff that you'll never read or learn anywhere, any other way. And I've talked over the past weeks of the concept of culture, of Torah culture, of having something ingrained, of a whole way of life, of doing things, of a nobility. That's what you'll see there, and you won't see in any books, and you won't see in any other way. But an effort has to be made to do it. And that's it. It's the concept of ensuring that an intimacy can develop, yet that intimacy shouldn't disturb the Yirush Shemayim, and shouldn't disturb the opportunity to learn, not only from one or from a few people, but whenever there's an opportunity to see an artist just as one would. One was a musical fanatic, one wouldn't let an opportunity like that pass. You must realize when there's a great person in town, it's an artist at work. And watch him.